And I say about the vertical, and I don't know. To me, it just sounds reasonable if you're going to have a vertical outside to have a path from the vertical directly to ground, or am I just, you know, wishful thinking over?
TWW, would another comment on grounding vertical?
Yeah, hold on there, Howie. I'm in 100% agreement with you, Mel. Whenever you've got any vertical piece of metal in your backyard, whether it be on the house, on the ground, or whatever, it behooves you to supply some form of path for the lightning that's either nearby or on the tower itself to be conducted to Earth. So local grounding can be very important. I think you've also got an upside-down metallic broom-like device that does quite a bit of discharging of of the top of your tower. I've heard a lot of people say pleasant things about one of those things as far as lowering the amount of noise your radios hear and doing a local discharge of a cloud before the strike occurs on your tower. I used to get a lot of radio noise in my 432 antenna, which was the tallest thing on the tower. And when I arranged things so that there's another 10 feet of mast sticking above the antenna, an awful lot of that growling noise from precipitation buildup on the tower disappeared, or essentially disappeared. So good grounding techniques for lightning is something we amateurs should definitely consider. Go ahead, Howie, KQRIW.
Especially on 6 feet of stick, running a quarter wave ground plane or a quarter wave trombone, which is a PD-128, which is basically a directly grounded antenna. I've noticed that the directly grounded antenna with the folded over, radiator, basically guaranteed me a much better noise floor, plus a safer. That's what I've noticed on FM, especially on 6 meters at a repeater site, about 400 feet above sea level. Definitely noticed that. I heard you make a comment saying that the most noise is horizontal. I thought most noise was vertical.
There, I'm not sure. And because guys that are comparing a horizontal antenna to a vertical antenna, which has very different elevation patterns, very different amounts of gain, very different azimuth patterns, different kinds of receivers in some cases, different signal-to-noise ratio, different amount of AGC action of the receiver. See, the AGC action of the receiver, when you get an S9 signal, that receiver has cut back about 30 or 40 dB of its potential gain. And that makes everything sound a lot quieter. So if you try to really compare horizontal noise to vertical noise, if you want to do it in a way that's traceable to the Bureau, you'd have to measure volts per meter with some kind of a known time constant of averaging, because the kind of noise we're talking about tends to be very brief with a very high, crest factor to it. So to make a quantitative measurement of the amount of vertical noise versus horizontal noise in your backyard in a way that's, as I said, traceable to zero, I think that's a very difficult measurement. You could get a zillion guys saying that vertical noise is always louder, but for all you know, they're using ground plane antennas with an insufficient number of radials, and all kinds of things are a variable there. So I don't know whether or not one is louder than the other. If you think vertical is louder, what do you believe is the mechanism that would make that happen, Howie? KQRIW.
I don't know what the mechanism is, but it's probably the way you hook it up, how many radios they have. But I've just found over the years that inverted V's, dipoles, especially on 10, 15, and 20, I've had less noise. Anytime I play with a vertical, out my window where I use the quarter wave vertical or a loaded antenna, I've had better results with dipoles and shorter dipoles. And that's living in an apartment building. I don't know what it would be if I was in a private house, but my experience has been that I get better reception with the horizontal antenna and less noise with the horizontal.
QIQ with a comment?
Mr. QIQ, I think it's Glenn this time, Craig Glenn.
Hey, good evening, Dick, to everyone on the net. Just a quick thing. I have an antenna that I can actually rotate from horizontal to vertical. It's basically a 10 through 20 meter beam. And I've taken a spectrum analyzer and plugged it on, and it's kind of like sweeping, you know, between, you know, roughly 30 megahertz down to about, you know, like say 10 megahertz in that area. It's kind of looked at broadband sweeps, put it in the vertical position, the horizontal position, and roughly the noise floor on the bottom tends to be a little bit higher in that frequency bandwidth, but in the vertical position over the horizontal. I'm not sure if that's really a very quantitative thing, but I do see it a little bit higher there.
Okay, very interesting. Down around 10 megs, you'd heard more noise. If you had to quantify it, you probably were running the spectrum analyzer at 10 dB per centimeter. What's a rough guess as to how much extra noise you saw vertical versus horizontal down at the low end, which I think you said was around 10 megs? Back to you, Glenn.
In bands on the frequencies, it's hard to tell, because as you sweep across, the antenna isn't extremely broadband. It's kind of like in sections, but like in sections of the band, like when I would narrow up the sweep into broadband areas, you could see that where the noise floor would kind of pick up. So I was trying to find the quiet spot in the band to see if I could actually see that difference between horizontal and vertical. But I was seeing differences as much as 20 dB there.
Wow. I expected your answer to be 5 dB. So you saw 20 decibels more noise when the antenna was set vertical versus horizontal, and that was the exact same antenna that you just simply rotating in polarization. I think you said it was a log periodic-like antenna. Glenn, go ahead.
The antenna is an MA5D, the Cushcraft, and it's basically a narrowband 10-meter antenna, a narrowband 20-meter antenna, and it also has another element in the middle that's kind of like a dipole that's like on a 12, 17-meter band. So you see, it's not a real broadband kind of an antenna, it's kind of narrow, but I was kind of looking at the overall sweep. But what was interesting was that in the out-of-band areas, you could still see things picking up in vertical. You know, the noise floor was coming up, but I'm not sure if that really quantitative, you know, in the in-band, but then again, you could also see on the flat side, when you're looking at the signals that were coming in, because, you know, the spectrum analyzer really is a receiver, and it was in horizontal, and looking at horizontally polarized signals, sometimes the signal would be lower, but you could see the noise floor dropping, so there was more signal-to-noise ratio, you know, in the horizontal position than there was in vertical.
Okay. Interesting. 20 decibels more noise, vertical versus horizontal. Wow. That's a lot. That's a lot to explain. I wonder if, Mel, you guys have run some experiments of horizontal versus vertical and noise. But what's your experience along these lines? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, this has been going on for quite a while now with me. K2KEY, I've been doing that experiment on 80 meters. And I've been doing it again. Basically, forget about the receiving loop inside the shack. That's a whole other story. But let's talk about the outside antenna with Mother Nature. And I got the horizontal loop, like I say, that's 272 feet of wire at 45 feet up for support. I have the vertical, 65-foot vertical with 100-foot radial. And I have a dipole at 65 feet. It's slightly, I could say it's somewhat of a V arrangement. It's not a complete 60. It goes from 65 feet down to about 35 feet approximately, the tie point. So I switch around, and and I just say, are we looking for background noise? I just have watched my panscope that's on the receiver, on the Collins receiver. I have a panscope. And I watch the baseline noise. At times, I'm looking for a lower baseline noise and a higher signal. There's the thing that I always try to strive for. Which one of the antennas gives me the best peak of signal and at the same time have the lowest noise floor? And most of the time, I will tell you exactly. The quietest of them all is the horizontal loop, the 272 feet of loop. The next one is the vertical. And the third is the dipole. The dipole seems to be consistently much noisier, whether it be baseline noise or whatever. It just seems like the dipole is more sensitive to noise for some reason to take over.
And just to double check, your dipole is horizontally polarized. And so if your dipole is giving you the most amount of noise and it's horizontally polarized, that is a bit different than Glenn's observation. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Now, well, this is at 80 meters. What happens on a higher frequency, going up to like 20 meters or so, I don't know. I haven't done that experiment on that. I can only tell you what I've gone through here on 80 meters, because I've been doing this extensively for over about 2 years now. So, all I can tell you is no one antenna fits the wall. And I'll tell you now what happens. Get on with people, and I've done this ABC test with them over and over again, and one night they'll tell me that the loop is the antenna, especially when I'm talking to guys like in my friends in Pennsylvania, and all, the loop seems to be the one that really has a tremendous signal that brings in it. For some reason, it's like a pipeline. It's maybe because it's somewhat of a cloud warmer. But then the guys that we also join us, we usually have 8 to 10 guys on frequency, and they're spread out anywhere from up north Massachusetts as far out as Oregon. I mean, and I'll switch antennas as many times, but they'll say, oh, whatever antenna, I go ABC, you know. And sometimes, of course, they'll tell me the dipole is the one that they hear me in California, but don't hear me on the loop. The DX station, that guarantee is the vertical all the time on the DX station, so you need a lot of antennas to cover the field over.
Doesn't surprise me, because sometimes the signal that you're talking to gets better there, horizontal, vertical, high angle radiation, low angle radiation. When in doubt, put up more antennas, particularly if they're wire. The wire is not that expensive. Horizontal, vertical, slant, 45, slopers. In your case, though, I'll bet you've got a lot of evidence that your 100 ground plane radial makes your particular, I think it's an 80-meter vertical, I bet you that 80-meter vertical acts quite a bit different than a lot of other people's 80-meter vertical. Is that true? Go ahead.
Yeah, the people that have had really success with 80-meter or 160-meter vertical, claim is the radial, the radial pattern. And that's the seems like it makes or breaks it. A lot of people have told me they gave up on the verticals, and I would question them. I said, well, how many radials? Well, I put down 4, I put down 6, or whatever it is that I could manage and everything. And then it did. Did you have a ground screen down? No ground screen at all. Just doesn't seem to really work. It seems my dipole was much superior all the time. But they did not do the true radio, you know, the vertical installation. That's the point. You're not going to get really any kind of result out of a vertical antenna, especially it depends on the soil. You've got a lot of the soil in this area, you know what we're dealing with. Unless you really put down that counterpoise, and this is not practical for a lot of people. A lot of people out of town and places out like, you know, when they got the acreage and everything, they just lay them out and let them migrate into the ground or bury them and all. But, you know, this is what I'm doing here in Brooklyn is an unusual situation, and that's why a lot of people chase after me. If they said I'm CW, I'm the only one they get in Queens County, some of the DX stations that our county hunts is over.
Interesting. Okay. I bet you wished from time to time after our recent discussions you had the ability, like have a tall enough tree, that you could mount either an 80 or a 40-meter pure vertical dipole. Is there a possibility that you have the resources to do that, Mel?
Yeah, I've had the vertical dipoles up. I had a 40-meter vertical dipole hanging off the top there, and that's the one I did the experiment with, tilting the angle, and to find that the best angle for that 40 meter is about 28 degrees with ground, say, in other words, that's a vertical dipole that hangs off the same base, the same support as where the, actually, it supports the, supports a lot of antennas, supports the 65-foot vertical or 80 meters, it supports the top portion of the rope that comes off a pulley there that holds the 80-meter catchy core, I could say, somewhat of an inverted V type of front dipole, and at the same time also supports the 40-meter loafer. So it's doing a lot of different things, think over.
Yeah, when you said that the best angle is 28 degrees from ground, do you mean 28 degrees from being perpendicular to the ground? Or do you really mean 28 degrees from ground, which means it's almost horizontal? Back to you, Mel.
If you sat at ground level, if you made a, you know, you drew a, say, ground level with a leveling device, and you looked at that angle where it's anchored down at the bottom, that angle that it's making the wire down at the bottom with so-called ground level is about 28 degrees. And I try to measure, I didn't do, you know, a precise measurement. I just took a level, held the level, and with a protractor, measured the angle that that ground, and I just stuck the protractor on top of the level, and looked at the bubble, and then looked at the angle wire is coming down at the ground point where it's connected over.
If possible, I think in the end of June, I'm going to have to make an arrangement to possibly take a peek of what goes on at Dover Street. Sounds like a fun operation. Back to you, Mel.
Okay. Yeah, I see a lot of interesting things going on. Yeah, everything is. You got to look for it. Got to show you the spots because I use a lot of camouflage. If you, yeah, I do. Right. Right, no eyesores. I'm getting a cross-eyed look because I got to be very careful that, you know, I don't ruin the vista, as they say here. Because if I had my way, this place would look like from a large spider did a job here. So I have to be very careful, you know. I have to keep things sort of under control. But why? That's one thing nice about wire. I use green wire. And you cannot see it. Literally, you have to look hard to see it. It's amazing how it disappears, Dick, over.
Well done. You blend with the territory. Do you think we should possibly read another letter out of the mailbag? It's your choice.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of one thing. When you said, you know, large propellers, just remembering that one comment. You remember we stood last year at that C-54. We were looking at the propeller they took off to remove the engine. If you remember that the propeller was sitting there with those big, that 12-foot stand propeller. was that a big enough propeller? Can you imagine that thing swinging around? I saw it, that plane, when it took off. I mean, that was one heck of a sight to see that thing move finally. You remember us standing there looking at that C-54 in the hangar that they were servicing with the engine off at the time. Well, they put it all together, but I remember we were looking, we were trying to figure out how they locked that propeller off from slipping, if you remember. We were looking at that huge shaft hop over.
WB2EA with a comment.
Ed recognized. Yeah, that was a huge propeller there at Floyd Bennett Field. And when that thing spins at 5,000 RPM, boy, the kinetic energy there has got to be fierce. And if one of the tips of those blades strikes anything, look out. Mr. EAV, you've got it. K2LIW.
1974. I spent 60 hours in the air in the back of a NASA 438. Intimately. It's got Pratt & Whitney R-1000. So, horsepower is a little below 2,000. Big props. The E2 I was on the other day is 1,000 shaft horsepower turboprops, two of them. props are a lot bigger. What was that C-54 doing there? Like I said, we are very close.
Yeah, that was under repair. That was a, what is it now, an antique airplane being put back into operation for a museum or something like this. Isn't that approximately what was going on there, Mel? Go ahead.
That was a donated plane. That was the one that was used in the Berlin airlift. That was one of the planes, one of the last of them left. And the guy saw what they were doing on it. The guy, that's the guy who flew it in there, flew it back out. And we were made, I figured, is he ever going to get this thing back together, you know? He had to replace the burnt, you know, worn out engines and everything. He's already doing, he had that thing apart, all the engines and everything. One off completely. In fact, there's a couple of engines laying there. Remember we saw out in the backyard laying a few of those huge engines. Those are big engines. And we were looking at the engines. I said, look at that. You can take home an engine if you remember, Dick. There were a bunch of them laying out in the backyard all left over. They were actually been laying there. I asked, how long are those engines there? Oh, they said forever. Who knows? They don't even remember when those engines were planted in the backyard there, over.
Yeah, Ed, with your interest in aircraft, you definitely want to, during the open house that takes place during field day, you want to visit Floyd Bennett Field, you want to start off at the Ryan Visitor Center, and then you want to have Mel give you a guided tour of the hangar they've got there and the aircraft they're repairing. You would jump up and down with enthusiasm. The show is a little bit better than the Cradle of Aviation Museum show. Over to you, Ed, K2RIW.
Duly noted, USL, into that. And if they have a C-54 there, that would really make my day. In 1974, we were flight testing a microwave landing system prototype. And at Wallops Island, Virginia. Let me put it this way. Harry Chapin wrote a song. There's a line. We learned about love in the back of a Dodge. Well, I learned about drinking in the back of a C-54.
Yeah, I'm hearing him both on the input and the output. He learned about Dramamine in the back of a C-54. You occasionally have a little bit of a dropout to the repeater, but I'm hearing you directly on the input, so I'm getting the full conversation here. Mel, why don't you tell Ed, if you happen to know the names of some of the other aircraft that were in that hangar and are likely to be in that hangar this coming June. End of this coming June, do you have the names of some of the other aircraft that are likely to be in that hangar? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, this is K2KEY. The C-54 is gone. They took that out. Think now, what's left? I don't know. I thought that was other planes. I don't know what we were looking at. The heck, I know the numbers of all of them. is that one that we were looking at, that combination prop plane and jet engine thing, whatever the heck that was some kind of a escort or a thing that chased submarines around. And then there's I don't know, a couple other things, a whole bunch of airplanes in there, plus you saw with a lot of engines, all kinds of engines sitting there that you can poke at, you know, everything just sits there. So you go in there, you want to touch engines and parts and things, you know, very, very easy to walk around there. You saw, Dick, we sort of poked around a lot of stuff. We actually walked under the wings and everything, so it's very liberal, as you know, Dick, over.
What T2V Neptune with the props against anti-submarines?
Good chance that's what it was. And correct me if I'm wrong, Mel. Do I remember seeing a Concorde airplane sitting out in front? Go ahead.
Got a Concorde. The Concorde that came off the Intrepid was lifted off, put on a barge, and they parked it there. Still parked there at Floyd Bennett. Who knows how long it's going to be there, because I don't know how long it's going to be for the Intrepid to return back to New York Harbor. So the Concorde will be there for quite a while. Yeah, and the airplane that I was describing, that thing in Case Submarines and all, it was like a high-wing aircraft with a jet engines and prop engines and who knows what, and had bombs. If you remember, Dick, we were looking at those, remember those bombs that were hanging under the wing? We were walking under the, and I said, I don't know, I didn't feel comfortable walking under that wing with those bombs that were hanging under there. You remember that, Dick? Over.
They'd have to be charges, not bombs.
You were sure that they were not auxiliary tanks? They really were ordnance of some kind? In any case, you'll enjoy it, Ed. Lots of good stuff to see there. And a Concorde, wow. Lots of good aircraft stuff to see. It's still a significant aircraft, history, location. I presume that there's a movement afoot to try to make that into a kind of a museum. On top of that, I have the impression that the Intrepid repair is now in sort of a holding pattern because I think they discovered that the repairs are going to be more expensive than originally anticipated. And I think they're looking for another $40 million. I think that's what I heard on the news tonight. Maybe you can correct me on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, it's K2KEY, yeah. $60 million, and they still can't get it done. So they built the ship for less money. Well, that was World War II, but I don't know what happened there. I thought it was, supposedly it was going in for a paint job and raping, you know, the marks there of the Hudson, and it was in good shape, the ship. I didn't see anything wrong with it. I was on it so many times. You know, it had normal wear and tear from World War II, everything and all, but it wasn't in bad shape as far as I'm concerned. So all the work had to be done just to fix the hull up, you know, and make sure that don't completely rot away or whatever. So I figured that they were just going to paint up, give it a nice coat of paint, and be done with it, but for some reason they got into all kinds of who knows what with this thing. Ran through $60 million, now they're going to wait again for donations to see if they can raise some more money to finish this thing up, but I don't think they'll ever have enough. You'll see, they'll run through millions and millions more, and then they'll say they'll need more millions, so I have no idea really what's going on with that thing. It was supposed to be a straightforward job. They quote, they see it, they calculate it all, and everything went wrong, which is par for the course, over.
Yep, I've heard of such stories. Most likely, Ed, you've never been to the Floyd Bennett Field hangar, main hangar, which is a kind of a quasi-museum, but except that you can, it's a touchy-feely museum by my standards. You can go over there and touch the wings and the fuselages and the stabilizers and the motors and the props and whatever, and the spares all over the place that you can go over and touch and feel and sometimes turn. I wonder, Ed, have you ever had a chance to actually visit the Intrepid? And in which case, I bet you that's a fun trip I'd like to do someday. WB2EAV, K2RIW.
WB2EAV. Yeah, I was there with the kids. And what was funny is I was showing the kids how things work. I looked around, and there were about a dozen people kind of eavesdropping, walking along with us, because they seemed to know more than the people who were paid to be there.
Okay, you've worked on some of that hardware. That makes some sense. At one time, I know the Intrepid did have a SR-71, in which case, was that there when you were there with your children? How close were you able to get to it? And ain't that a fancy-looking aeroplane? Over to you, Ed.
The designation of the one that they have is the A-12. I have no idea where they got that from. All I've ever heard of is SR-71. It was obviously the same plane, but it was marked with the designation A-12. But yep, it was there.
Yeah, A-12 is the predecessor to SR-71. Kelly Johnson's genius was first applied to the A-12, and with minor modifications by my standards, became SR-71. A-12 has got 95% of the capability of an SR-71. When you read Ben Rich's book called Skunk Works, or you read any of the other SR-71 books, I've got quite a few of them, because I've worked on that airplane. What a piece of hardware. That thing... I don't care if it's a 1963 design. It's still way ahead of its time. And just sitting on the ground, doesn't that thing look like it's moving a million miles an hour? Back to you, Ed.
The only word to describe it is breathtaking. And while I think a million miles an hour is a little bit of an exaggeration, that's the idea.
Can you imagine an airplane that flies on full afterburner all the time when it's doing a mission, and it gives the best possible mileage at Mach 3.2 at 90,000 feet? And when you come down to 38,000 feet to refuel it, it burns up fuel three times faster. That thing was very specifically designed for a particular high-speed, high-altitude environment. And when it's flying at Mach 3, as far as the airplane's concerned, it's slow flying. It's at the threshold of stall when it's at 90,000 feet because there's so little air up there. And when you make a U-turn, it takes something as big as the state of New York to make a U-turn. I think the speed record with that thing is they flew, I believe, from London to Dulles in something like an hour and 20 minutes. And then I think they flew from Dulles to Los Angeles in something like an hour and a half, or, you know, averaging 2,500 miles an hour type stuff. That thing can, with one fueling in each one of those missions, that thing can move. Back to you, Ed, for any of the comments. K2RIW.
Yes, I will say that was a truly spectacular feat of engineering. But you do have to point out, it did come at cost. I mean, that thing was so finicky, so persnickety, they had to load it up with liquid nitrogen to this, they had to load it up with helium to do that. Of course, it had to have liquid oxygen for the pilot. It had all of this stuff. It was an absolute nightmare to maintain. But the beauty was, what it did was so perfect and so unique that they gladly did all the nonsense. And discontinued them when they obsoleted them. Believe that they haven't found a better replacement. We just don't know about yet. But because I just can't believe they're managing without it.
In theory, satellites do a fair amount of the work that it could do. That's the good news. The bad news is the satellite is very predictable as to where it's going to be when. Whereas that aircraft, you had no way of knowing where it was going to be when. So therefore, it could take a very surprised look at anything you wanted to see. So it had its purpose. Yes, it was expensive to maintain, but it could do things that nothing else could do. I don't think there is a true replacement for it of anything that's any better, Ed. And the main reason for that is Kelly Johnson died. You've got to find another Kelly Johnson. That guy understood aerodynamics like nobody else. Ben Rich, his replacement, came close when he designed the F-117, but that's a very different aircraft for a very different application. Now, that 71 was, it is still ahead of its time. I don't care if it's a 45-year-old airplane. It's a 19, the basic design was roughly 1963, 65, so I guess that makes it 42, 43-year-old design. So, Kelly Johnson was only 45 years ahead of his time, is one way of looking at it. Ed, go ahead.
I'm used to that. The E-2 came out in 1962, and the E-2D looks exactly the same. And they're talking about flying, by the way, to answer your question about an hour ago, they're talking about buying 75 of them to start, and I think they're supposed to be in service to something like close to 2030.
Now, is some of that manufacturer going to be offset and foreign manufacturer, and are some of them for foreign use, or is every one of them, to your knowledge, and I think you said 75 or 78 aircraft ship sets, Are all of those going to be domestic use or some of them foreign use to your knowledge, Ed? Go ahead.
The 75 is U.S. Navy. This is what they're talking about at the moment that could possibly go up. There are a number of foreign countries that are interested, but nobody has committed to anything yet.
And that makes sense. They're going to wait until it becomes a thoroughly debugged production unit. And by the time 15 or 20 of them have been successfully shipped, there's going to be orders from other countries. I can see that coming. Now, that's a unique airplane. Nothing's going to replace that. When it comes to something with legs, you cannot beat a turboprop. No jet engine comes close. When it comes to a picket ship, that kind of an antenna, and I know what that antenna can do, because I've talked to some of the people who worked on the antenna design, nothing can come close to that antenna in that location doing that visibility that it does. There's not going to be anything to replace that for lots of decades. And so it's going to be around a while. There's just no two ways about it. The EA-6B aircraft, for what it does, that again was a 1965 design. And people thought that that's going to become obsolete. As a standoff jammer, I don't think anything comes close to it. And so I think we're going to be using them for a long time to come. Some definite upgrades are required for the direction finding and receiving system. But still, the basic transmitting system, I don't think you have to upgrade that very much. I think those aircraft are going to be around a long time. You may have an opinion on that one, Ed. K2RIW.
The Marines, I believe, are going with the EA-6B with the so-called atmospheric upgrade. The NICB is moving to put the electronic suite from the EA-6B upgrade onto an IP. And it's the EA.
Yeah, I've heard that story, and I think a small number of them are going to be built. But that aircraft doesn't have anywhere near as much engine or legs. I don't think that's going to do the same job. What do you think?
Way past the of those questions. Whether or not your questions have been answered to your liking, I think they're proceeding as if the answer was no problem. May turn out they're wrong, but from what I can see, they're proceeding like the answer is no problem.
Okay, so they're going to be experimenting with an 18 equivalent. I hope they're not obsoleting a significant number or mothballing the EA-6Bs anytime in the near future. Is that true?
Metal fatigue. The wings can fall off.
You can always replace the wing spars. That's a hell of a lot easier. The bird in hand, the thing you know about, is a hell of a lot better than something you don't know about. I don't care if the spars are running into metal fatigue because of age. That's a replaceable item by my standards, Ed. Go ahead.
I can assure you the Navy has not sought my opinion.
Okay. So do you think that the EA-6 Bravos are being mothballed?
As I understand it, the Marines are keeping theirs, and the Navy is going to be giving them their newer ones to replace those that are being retired just to excessive airframe hours, as the NICB brings out the EA-18Gs. This is my understanding of the plan. However, I cannot guarantee that it's going to go according to the plan. The best laid plans of mice, let me try that again. The best laid plans of mice and men oft go astray. Robert Burns.
Off go astray or off time go awry? I've heard both versions. Make me a guess. How many EA-6 Bravos are in service, Navy and or Marines? Go ahead.
This is a guess. I have no credentials. 100.
Good number. Glad to hear it. Okay. We settled that one, Mel. Hey, Mel. Any more good questions in your mailbag? Or anything else you'd like to discuss? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Let's try to get a couple in. Yeah, there's facts. I was reading the New York Times. There's a company gonna, in the midst of building the supersonic aircraft similar to the Concorde, except they're going to make them for only 12 passengers for private use. You know, somebody who wants a high-performance aircraft to take them back and forth to Europe or whatever. They have designed now and going into production. I don't know, I guess for executive use, but it's only, I guess they're only going to seat a maximum of 12 people. So. All right, well, anyhow, not my near future purchase, let's put it that way. Let's see. Oh, yeah, here's a question. Should we take another question? Over.
Absolutely. Fire away.
Okay, last week you guys were discussing power supply. And you mentioned this one made by the design of X22FOD, Manfred. Can I buy this power supply somewhere, or do you know of anyone making it in any form of kit or whatever? I don't think it's on the market commercially. Maybe you, Mel Spikey, are more familiar with this than I am, Dick Over.
Yeah, at the time that Manfred came out with that article, December issue, 1999, QST, and then the second half of the article was the January 2000 issue of QST. I had lots of communication back and forth with him because I was attempting to enter into a partnership agreement between me, Manfred, and a third person who shall remain nameless, but if I gave you the name, you guys would recognize him. There was a third person that we were going to go into a partnership of making a similar power supply combined with another piece of the transmitting equipment. And so I had lots of conversations with him as to the origin of that power supply, how it came about, what efforts he went through to perfect it, and so on. I am almost positive nobody is building that power supply. Each person I know who looks at that schematic says, boy, that's a beautiful power supply, but why does it have so many parts? You read the article carefully, and you go to his website, and you get the rest of the article, which is twice as big as the original article, which already was in two sections. You get his website article, and you read how that thing became developed, and you realize that every single part there is there for a reason, with some form of efficiency improvement, longevity improvement, survivability, whatever. Every part is there for a reason. Because he wanted a really robust power supply that he could put at his repeater sites on top of the mountains in Chile. And the last thing in the world he wants to do is revisit those mountains to repair a power supply when he drops. So from his point of view, every part that's there is needed to give him that reliability and that efficiency. However, I don't think there's anybody in Japan, China, United States, or South America that is willing to build that power supply. It's got so many parts. The parts are a little bit on the exotic side. That transformer is a hand-built, very exotic thing. Nobody in the world builds anything that's even close to that transformer. So it's not a problem of vanishing vendors. It's a problem of non-existing vendors. So the only problem with that power supply is it's expensive, and the parts don't exist. Other than that, from a production point of view, it's beautiful. That's a joke. Nobody's going to build that. You want that power supply, you whip out those parts, you whip out your tools for making epoxy, and you build that thing with your own hands. Nobody's going to build that. Great power supply, you got to bite the bullet and build it. You can't buy that. If you and I were in the business of selling that, we would starve. The reason we would starve is we would have to charge a pretty big price to make a profit. And because there is so damn much competition from super cheap power supplies, for one-third the number of dollars, you could buy the same number of amperes from Estron. but it doesn't have that efficiency, that size, that reliability, that self-protection. If you want those properties, you build that supply. But you'll never make a profit selling it. My high prediction is nobody will ever build that as a commercial product. Now you know why. Strongly felt opinion, and I'd like to be corrected. I would love to find out that some little old guy in Japan is building that and selling it, but I highly doubt it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY, that's on mute right now. That's the power supply that this is powering this radio right now at 50 watts, 55 watts, and it will, I built it into a little different style, built it into a cubic. It's a cube, about, say, about 6, 8, 7 inches deep, about 4 inches high, and about 8 inches wide. So I made it into a cube. I redesigned it somewhat. In fact, I reused a different, little different approach as far as cost and everything, but basically the same thing. But the transformer, I made the transformer. It wasn't that difficult to make that transformer. I mean, after winding plate transformers and all, you know, big power transformers, I wound, you know, monster transformers here, you know, all rewound them and all, but I didn't find that transformer, you know, as anything really of any difficulty to put together. It's kind of straightforward, that, you know, that many turns. It wasn't really a big deal to make that. That's just the whole heart of it. The rest of the parts are more or less off the shelf. There's nothing, you know, I don't know, really super exotic in there. But what I use basically in that is my regulator and driver. Basically, I salvaged that from a computer power supply. I salvaged, I got the, that's where the oscillators, the feedback, the regulators, and all that is basically from that. And then I added that onto his output circuit and stuck with that system that he used. You know, so I got like a sort of a hybrid version of it, but closely follows along, and what can I say, it works excellent. No pain, no strain with this thing for the last few years, so what can I say, too bad that you said we'd lose your shirt if you went into production on it, I assume. All right, that's the story. I'm sure we'll try one more.
Yeah, we should definitely try one more, and I forgot to mention it's a switching power supply that makes no electromagnetic interference, so it is compact, switching power supply, no electromagnetic interference, high efficiency, lots of self-protect, lots of self-indication. So it's an engineer's power supply. It is not an economic component, and you'd never sell enough of them. You'd have to talk some power supply transformer manufacturer into making an extremely unusual transformer that would be good for one product only. And so that lack of universality of key components, that lack of demand for all of that performance, would make sale of that at a profitable rate very difficult. Go to the next mailbag if you like. K2RIW.
How many amps?
40 amps. 13 volts, 40 amps. Switching regulator.
Yeah, I think, you know, I took this power supply and I loaded it down. You know, I was able to hold it at 45 amps. I held it at 45 amps. I wanted to see how hot the thing would get. It started to warm up quite a bit. But at 30 amps or so, normally you could run maybe with a transceiver 30 amps at most and all. It just, right now, I'm 15. Right now I'm drawing, what am I drawing? Drawing about 12 amps, drawing 12 amps right now, and it's absolutely ice cold, so no problem whatsoever with it. Phenomenal piece of gear, and I think it's easily duplicated, but all right, that's my opinion. All right, let's see. Here's a question. Let's see what a question this is. Oh boy, that's a good one. How do you test power amplifier tubes? I got a whole bunch of them. I was able to pick up from somebody all kinds of power amplifiers. 4X150, 4CX250, And on and on and on since 304s and H-12s and 811s and this and that and everything. Oh, this looks stupid. My God. How can I test them without a rig? Got any ideas how to test? Six, over.
You may have some better ways, Ed, but I'm at Mel, but that's a tough one in my opinion. We can either buy, build, or get a hold of a tube tester that will apply the right filament voltage, maybe the right screen and plate voltage, and measure emission, and maybe you can measure whether or not the tube has got some gas in it. But I have seen tubes where a 4CX250B on a tube tester measures beautiful. You put it into a half kilowatt amplifier, and the thing behaves terribly. Correspondingly, I've seen tubes on a tube tester that measure that they're a little bit gassy and a little bit low in emission. You put them in a high power amplifier and drive them 10% harder, and they put out beautiful RF power. So, a go, no-go test, whether or not you've got an open filament, whether you've got a cathode that's got some emission, and whether you've got a whole lot of gas in the tube, a tube tester, home built, or maybe there's a commercial one that can do it, those tubes can be tested. That only brings you 60% of the way there, in my opinion. That last 40% is really, how does it behave in a real amplifier on the full power output? And I don't think a tube tester can always confirm that for you. I've seen too many exceptions. K2KEY, K2RIW.
WB2EAB with a comment on that.
Okay, give us your comment, Ed, while you're there.
That list we heard is quite an eclectic list, and they all are rather complicated mechanical socketing and or chimney arrangements. That you probably would need 10, just from the list I heard, you need 10 different, wildly different mechanical arrangements with sockets, chimneys, cooling fans, etc. That alone would probably be staggering in cost.
Hey, you're doubly confirming it's a darn difficult problem. I could build adapter sockets to get it into a tube tester. But the tube testers I can get my hands on are only going to measure 10% of the performance of that tube. Until I put it into a high-power amplifier, I would never be sure. How would you solve that one, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Hey, I sort of been there. I see in the tubes is surplus now. I had a big source one time of surplus tubes, and because they were junking a lot of military equipment, so I was salvaging tubes, feeders. I was making a little money like that. I gave away most of it very cheap. There's a place here in Brooklyn called Seco, C-E-C-O, and I knew the guy who that owned it, and I bring him tubes, and, you know, we would do what we call a basic go-no-go. In other words, just to see if the tube was a throwaway or maybe you should go further with the tube. And what we did, basically, first thing we did, of course, was light up the filament. That's easy enough with a couple of clip leads to clip on the filament up. After that, what we do, we had a number of, I set up a number of, actually, lamps with a voltage supply to these lamps, and was just to make short circuit tests of the tube, just to see if there was any inter-element shorts in it, basically. Dick, let me let it go. Then, to go to the next step, because, you know, again, this was all done with clip leads, so it was basically with a meter. I remember setting it up that we did things like basic, what was known as static conductance testing. And then you could also rig up a little thing that you could do dynamic transconductance testing also. It was a little jig that we made up just to see if the tubes had a go or no-go, you know, this way. And I remember we were able to determine quite a bit, pick out the tubes that really were really bad by this method. And then, of course, give you a guarantee that you sold it to a customer, didn't work out, well, send it back and give you another one. What else can you do? But it just, you know, like you say, it's not a simple way to go the full way and know exactly how it's going to behave in a high-power transmitter over.
If you had that problem, Ed, what would you do?
I think Mel hit the nail on the head. About all you can do is a transconductance test. And as Mel said, if you fail the transconductance test, throw it in the garbage. But like you said, Dick, that gives you maybe 60%. What about the other 40%? And I guess the other 40% is you need an amplifier that uses that tube type. You drop it in, run it into a dummy load, and see what it'll do. I can't see anything easier than that to do that last 40%.
Yeah, not many of us own a tube tester, own an amplifier that'll take a 1625, an 807, a 4X150, a 4X250, an 813, and so on. Not many of us own a rig for each one of those tube types. And I guess with some difficulty you could make adapter sockets in a couple of those cases. And the good news is that rarely did I see a tube like a 4CX250B, which would behave well at 144 megs, but suddenly die at 432. You put it under full load at a good VHF frequency. It doesn't have to be the highest possible frequency. You're measuring 95% of what it's capable of doing. But to put it under full load, you got to run it into the real Class C or Class AB1 service to really see what it can do. Because in real service, particularly Class C service, there are spikes of current that you're demanding from that cathode for only a 70-degree conduction angle. But if the tube is producing half an ampere of average current, you're probably asking for a 1 3/4 ampere spike for a 70-degree conduction angle. Within reason, that's very difficult to test with a tube tester. Oh, I can think of ways of making a very brief pulse tube tester, but it would be a pretty exotic piece of machinery. The right way to do it is to put it into a real amplifier. So there's no glamour fix on this one as I see it now. It's a tough requirement if you really want to ring out the tube. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, one of the tests that we made, we actually used a crude tube tester. If you remember the drugstores they used to stock, they used to have that thing there, you know, test your tubes in the drugstore. It was basically just a, you know, an emission tester. It was spots, you know, what was known as a really bad tube with no emission. Of course, other than that, most of the time it was worthless, those drugstore type, you know, tube testers. However, you could get a go and no-go by this method. You know, doing an emission test, doing, like I said, the short and all. But there was some professional, you know, there was, you know, a lot of shops. I mean, we had the shop, you know, we had, remember that Simpson put out, or one of Superior put out, I remember Superior, you know, a mutual conductance or trans-conductance tube tester. And it worked, you know, to some extent, at least, you know, by using methods of this type. Like you say, you can find which tubes you're going to just literally not go any further with. Get at least 50%, knowing that the filament, you know, short, that it's got some emission. In other words, even at low rate, but at least it shows that the tube is doing something. That's about all I can think of, Dick, over.
Good point. Okay, we're a minute away from the bewitching hour. You guys have spent another couple hours of your life listening to TechNet number 1189 of the series that began in 1982 in September. On the assumption we stay healthy, Mel and I will be back next week with our group of friends to help answer some of these questions. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. Mel, back.